Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the May 1st, 2020 forum featuring Bob Rivers, Chairman and CEO of Eastern Bank. I'm Warren Zola, the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields, who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Bob joined us for a series we call Conversations with CEOs, as he spoke with me and we engaged in a Q&A with our members. The conversation focused on the impact of COVID-19 on small businesses and the racial equity gap. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. We're extremely fortunate today to have the chair and CEO of Eastern Bank with us, and obviously a wonderful person, a member of our Board of Governors, Bob Rivers. So Bob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Warren. It's great to be with you all. I hope everyone's doing okay out there.
We'll get started. As everyone knows, I sent out an email, but while there's a lot to cover today, Bob and I have a focus for today's conversation. Historically, Boston has been perceived as a racist city in many ways, unfortunately. And those inequities are being laid bare in today's world. We need to address the needs of the minority business community unless we're willing to accept that the racial equity gap will widen. And so Bob has decided, and I have decided, that this is a relevant topic for both today and our city. And so that's what we're going to focus most of our time on today. Let me start with an easy question, Bob, and you and I have discussed this, but why does the racial equity gap matter for our city and region? Why is it something that really should be top of mind for us today?
Yeah, well, first of all, Warren, I really appreciate the opportunity to focus on this particular subject, this issue, the set. This has been a real focus of our advocacy for quite some time, and it has never been more intense right now during these times that have laid bare all the inequities that we know of throughout our community and our society and our economy. It's critically important that we address this, I think now more than ever, but it's always been the case. First and foremost, this is the right thing to do from a social perspective, social justice perspective. It's a moral imperative. So that's really where I'd start on this. But I think also from a business perspective, this is a matter of our city's and region's reputation. Again, as you referenced, Warren, you know, we have a reputation as a racist city, and we could debate that characterization of it, but the data clearly bears that out in so many ways, and clearly the experiences of many others that don't look like me bear that out too, and that has an impact on the city's reputation and elsewhere, and it becomes a matter of talent attraction. I mean, we've heard the stories. People of color don't want to come to Boston. They don't see it as a welcoming place. And those that come here for college don't want to stay. So as we look at attracting the very best talent, retaining it, and developing it for those who grew up here, you know, our ability to grow this economy, to develop this business community, is really dependent upon addressing this issue once and for all in a meaningful way. Of course, that also extends to action and retention as well. So again, this is a matter of the right thing to do, but just as much the smart thing to do for businesses.
And does this opportunity and this challenge that we're facing today give, you think, the city and the region an opportunity to sort of reset and recalibrate sort of the perspective and what we can be doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's hardest to do in times when we're all challenged on a number of fronts and there are so many communities and so many issues to address. Clearly, it would have been better to have done this during more advantaged times. But we largely didn't. Where we are, I think this moment gives us an urgency perhaps that we didn't have in the past to address this. And it perhaps is in the eyes of many to see, whether it be from a healthcare perspective, an access to education perspective via the internet now when so many don't have access to broadband, whether it be to employment, where so many of our frontline workers, our workers, are people of color, are women that are out there, because and they are the ones really serving us. Again, I think that those, this moment, I think, really drives that imperative and that urgency. And I'd like to think that we'll all rally around it and make more meaningful progress.
And I should have mentioned at the beginning, sorry, a little bit of ground rules here. My plan is that Bob and I will speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll open it up to our members for questions at around 10 o'clock, have about 20 minutes worth of that, and then Bob and I will wrap things up so we are done promptly at around 10:30, so apologies. But I want to come back to what you're talking about there, Bob. One of the things that concerns, I think, all of us is trying to think about not only sort of in general this gap that seems to be widening, but what are the sectors in our city that are being hit the hardest by this, and what does that mean for us moving forward?
Well, from the business community's perspective, I mean, the sectors we all know well, because we have friends that work within those sectors, or we were customers of those sectors. And first and foremost, certainly it's restaurants, bars, hospitality, food service, hair care, all of those things. And again, when you look at how where businesses of color are concentrated, they are concentrated within those sectors. So those sectors are hard hit no matter who you are. But certainly for these particular communities, it is particularly devastating.
And you've also been intimately involved, as has Eastern Bank and your team, including Quincy Miller, who's been in the papers a little bit as well with the work that he and the bank have been doing. But how is the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP program, going? What are the issues that you're dealing with on a daily basis, and how things are moving forward along that, both well and then with the stumbling blocks?
Yeah, no, it is the as I'm sure you've all read or experienced, has been a real challenge in so many ways for borrowers, for the banks involved, and certainly for the government. This is a brand new program. Put together with all good intention to get relief out to businesses, particularly smaller businesses, those less than 500 employees, as quickly as possible. It's a brand new program, and normally these kinds of programs take months to vet, to structure, in a matter of days. As it was rolled out, and really through the first week, and really on occasion, really even now, some of the particulars are being refined. It became a very confusing process for all involved. Obviously, the demand has been overwhelming. Supply available has been limited. So it was set up on a first-come, first-served basis. And this is really what led to many of the inequities in delivering the program. Because in essence, the largest companies within that grouping, again, up to 500 employees, were funded first because they have more resources. It wasn't because banks prioritized them first. It wasn't because they got any particular preferential treatment per se. But what they did have great advantage in was having a good-sized staff, a dedicated financial officer, a CFO, a dedicated law firm, an accounting firm, with resources to work through this program, figure out the changes, keep up with things as they evolved. And as a result, larger companies were able to complete applications much more quickly than smaller companies, particularly those, say, with less than 25 employees, an enormous challenge. Again, there aren't those resources in so many ways. People really left to their devices. Oftentimes, they didn't have a dedicated relationship with a bank. They had a banking account, but they didn't deal with a banker per se and have an assigned account officer. So yet again, another resource not available to them. So when you look at the funding in the round versus the second, you can already see the dramatic differences. In the first round, loan that was made across the United States was $200,000 in the first round of PPP. Now, already in the second round of the program, it's now $45,000. Again, because all the largest companies are taken care of in the very earliest days of the program. And now the smaller companies are catching up. The problem is money's running out. And this round will run out pretty soon. And again, there'll be a number of companies left behind. Within that left behind number will be a very high concentration of businesses of color. Because they are among our smallest businesses, and also because they have a natural distrust of banks and of government based on a whole lot of history that we've all heard about. There are language barriers. Many haven't even applied for the program, and so it would help them in many ways. So a lot of outreach to happen to make businesses aware of and comfortable with these programs. So, long and short, Warren, this whole program has been a nightmare for all involved. And every day there's a new story, a new nuance, and that'll continue. There are many chapters to go. I believe there needs to be a third round, although I think the fight over that one's going to be intense and slow. But it's really important because the businesses, again, most left behind are our very smallest, and particularly those that are led by people of color and led by women. So we need a dedicated funding pool for those groups that won't go away. And I would argue that dedicated funding pool really needs to be grants, not loans. So much of this program is going to be not paid back anyway. Yeah. The largest company who have the resources to maintain staffing will get the forgiveness. The very smallest companies who can't get this will be layered on with more debt that they can't pay back anyway. So we might as well just give grants out to the smallest business, help improve their odds of getting to the other side.
So, I mean, you touched on a lot of things there, and I'd like to go into to many of them deeper with time permitting. But let me start with, so let's pretend either we have people on this call who have missed out on those first two rounds, or they know people who've missed out. Do you have advice to anyone in terms of how to raise your hand for your business and seek out this opportunity, whether it's now, round two, round three, or to play an advocacy role in terms of trying to convince people that they should go from loan to grant?
Well, first of all, for round two, which is an exhaustive. So if you have an application in somewhere and you don't know its status, then the first recommendation obviously is to call your bank. Now, if you don't have a dedicated account officer, you can't get response. And the SBA would not like this advice, but is you should submit your application to another bank. And that's what a lot of people have done. It's also one of the things that's inflated the processing volume, I will tell you, is could people submitted multiple applications at different banks to improve their odds in this lottery, hoping that one of those applications would finally get through. I had a customer of one of our large banks here locally call me recently and asked my advice on this very question. They had filed early in round one, missed the cut, were still waiting, hadn't heard in round two, get a response, and they knew that we were a non-customer applicant. Said to him was, even them, we're customers first, and to non-customers and to help you. So what I'd rather for application and window in this. And see if they'll process it for those that will take non-customers. That customer went and did, found a very small community bank in Boston, filed that application, and it was approved for existing larger bank. But that's the thing, unfortunately, you have to do, because at the end of the day, as a business, of course, you've got to do whatever you have to do to get the resources that you need. So that's why I would advise everyone, if you haven't applied and you feel like you need it, please move quickly. But again, I think many are going to be left behind. We see it in the large number of non-customer applications that we have that simply exist because there are some banks not participating in this program, or under their definitions, they didn't count as a customer. So we know that there's going to be many businesses left behind, and hence the need for round three. I mean, this program's been underfunded. This is a program that was originally rolled out at $350 billion. The second round was $310 billion. But this is a program that required $1 trillion. So there's no doubt that there'll be loud clamoring for a next round. And here we go again.
And it seems like it seems like that Eastern Bank, through the leadership of both you and your predecessor, who's joined us, Richard Holbrook, so welcome, Richard, is sort of positioned for this as a local community bank with huge sort of powers. And I think that comes to bear. You recently co-wrote an opinion piece on the Globe with Betty Francisco, Steve Grossman, and Segun Idowu, that discussed how minority-owned businesses are being left behind. And again, that advice is something that you've shared with us today, but it seems that Eastern Bank seems to be positioned well for this, not in terms of taking advantage of it, but as a organization that has been doing good for small businesses in our region for a long time. And I think that that should be applauded, but also is that something that you anticipated, or this is part of the ethos of your bank?
It's really part of the way we've done business. That's a culture that's been established here long before me, long before Rich, that both he and I, and now Quincy and I, carry forward, and that really runs through the company. This seems like a wonderful marketing opportunity, but that's not our goal. Mm-hmm. We went into this program and instructed our people that this payment protection program is not a prospecting opportunity. We are not here to take advantage of other banks who are struggling with the program and may not be up there by taking their customers. That's not what we're trying to do. We need to handle our own customers first. And where we hear of customers who are adrift, we need to reach out and let them know the customer adrift. And there were some very large organizations, names you would all know, reached out to me that aren't customers of Eastern, asking if we could help because simply their bank was not able to get it done. And I was telling the senior leaders of other banks, making them aware that their customers were calling us because they were concerned for whatever reason they were not going to be served by that bank. This is a need to stand together and each focus on our customers and have a very broad definition on those customers. And ours has been the broadest that I'm aware of. We didn't restrict this just to our business customers. If you had a small personal CD here, but you had your business accounts elsewhere, we considered you a customer and put you first in the line. So again, we did that to cast a broad net because this opportunity to has helped many people as possible. There'll be a lot written going forward, I'm sure, about the fees that the banks are making on this program. And some of the numbers are going to seem pretty large. But I assure you, as an economic endeavor, this is not a good trade at all. And anything that anyone would do for business reasons alone. This is public service. This is the banks staying together. And if you don't believe me, you just talk to any one of hundreds of my colleagues who are literally working around the clock to input, process, book, and fund apps, including our president, Quincy Miller, who has been right on the line with them, typing in applications.
Well, and I also think that as this progresses and we think about, this community, right, the city of Boston and this collaboration that so many of our leaders have, it's both a small and a large city, which I think makes it such a wonderful place. You know, we need to come together. And as we think about what we can do today, I know that you've been active with the Massachusetts COVID-19 Relief Fund. I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what it is and why it's so important to you and to our region.
Oh, sure. you know, thankfully, right out of the gate, starting with the Boston Resilience Fund, Jeff Leiden's leadership in particular, but also many others, people have stepped up everywhere. I think the business community has shown itself really well in this moment by bringing forth resources to help people in so many ways, philanthropically, through retooling their own operations to produce PPE, to using their actions to find resources for people on the front lines. It's really been quite admirable. So this has been one of the ways that we've tried to help. We were honored when the governor reached out to us to help this fund. That was simply done, one, I think, is a matter of our reputation, but two, because we have a couple different charitable foundations here, the hope that we had a ready receptacle and a means of collecting the checks, both via mail and online, which is what our role is as the eight, to do that. And the thing about this fund beyond our own, of course, is this fund serves everyone in the Commonwealth. It's not a particular region alone, and it's really focused on our most underserved populations, if you will, in this time. Those that are most threatened. First of all, our frontline workers who deserve our endless gratitude for putting their lives on the line to serve so many of us when we've become ill. But there are other populations. Give, again, Governor Baker a lot of credit for this, because this took a certain amount of political guts, if you will, for someone who is from the Republican Party. So I think that only adds to the courage here, frankly, is the focus on populations, undocumented immigrants, by this fund. Our undocumented immigrants have jobs here, as everyone knows, and they pay taxes on those jobs. Yet they were not at all eligible to receive relief under the CARES Act. So they've lost their jobs because they're concentrated in service community, no source of income and no source of relief. Called out that community in particular as one of the about half dozen. That much makes it very notable and very resonant with us.
And so when you think about sort of this relief fund and the themes that you've spoken about today in terms of access, you know, give us what happens to our region if we don't address this gap or the divide? What does Boston look like in 5 or 10 years if we don't take proactive steps today to sort of address things? What's that scenario play out? How's that play out?
Yeah, well, certainly when it comes to inequities, certainly racial inequities, this crisis has put all of that on steroids. If you thought we had a wealth gap before, it's getting ever wider by the day. And unaddressed, what we're going to end up with is a community that doesn't represent the country. It doesn't look like the country. It doesn't look like the world. It doesn't look like a place you can come and be successful here. It isn't a place that you want to move and join a company here. And as a result, the access to talent will become increasingly limited. And that, of course, translates into lesser growth for the region.
It feels like we both have this great opportunity, but also this great threat if we don't come together. And
yeah, I agree.
Right. And it's these sorts of events like today's event, not but as Boston College Chief Executives Club specifically, but these opportunities for our business leaders to come together and to discuss these issues, but also to think critically about what we need to be doing today from our couch, our living room, our office, if we're able to get in there, to make sure that both our businesses are successful, but also this region continues to thrive, right? This is a really important city, region, and you think about all the students that are coming through here, all the prospective employees, we need to get it right, and this is a great way to sort of reset. I have a couple more questions lined up, but I've got a bunch of folks who are in the industry who have some some questions. So I'm actually going to turn it over a little bit early to our audience. And I'm going to start off with, we have someone from Leader Bank, Sushi Tuli, who has asked some questions about how they're handling small business. So I'm going to turn it over to our members, and we'll start with Sushil, please. Let's
see if we can. Okay. Good morning, Al. Bob, thank you so much. Great talk. Every time I meet with you, I listen to you, I learn something new. It's so nice to have a leader like you in the banking community. So I wanted to share like how at Leader Bank during the first round and second round, what we did to help out the small business owners. So during the first round, what we did was, because of the limited resources we have, we put a internal limit that we will not do any loan more than $3 million if a person is not our customer. So we wanted to make sure our resources are dedicated to small business owners. Then I created a separate team. That team was only helping people less than $50,000 loan amounts. And the reason was, as Bob said, the big company, the big people, they have CPAs, they have attorneys who can guide them. These small little guys, they have no idea. They heard about the program, they want to apply. They applied at some big banks and they cannot get to anybody. So we had a dedicated team only to help those guys. And we still continue to do that. And because of that, so Bob said it's so right. The goal for banks here is not to make money. The goal is to help people. And honestly, that's what we are doing. Bring in, help all those small people who can keep their businesses open, who can keep their employees employed there. And we have done hundreds of loans. And my smallest loan is $1,300. And my $1,300 customer is as valuable to me as $3 million. And so that's one of the things we're doing. The challenges are getting these loans processed. Now they are registered, we continue to register, but getting them processed, closed, and funded. And then report to SBA. You guys don't know on the background, we have to, within 10 calendar days, we have to underwrite these loans, fund these loans, and close. I have shifts running all 24 hours a day, different people working to make sure. Like we are so much caught up registering the loans, like in my pipelines, every day we have no more than 15, 20 more loans to left. And those are the ones people who have not submitted the documents. Otherwise, we are helping out everybody. And then we are underwriting, different team is underwriting, and then we want to fund these loans. The first round, we did 92% of the people who applied, and 100% of them are funded already. And the second round, we started funding, and within 10 calendar days, we have to fund them. And then we have to report to SBA. Believe me, it's a big challenge for banks to do that. And we are very proud. I mean, this is a time when all the small business owners, large business owners, to work together to make sure the economy of our state flourishes. And we even don't do loans out of state. I mean, if we have a client who has a business out of state, we'll do it. Otherwise, we are only helping people in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and Sushil, you guys are amazing. I mean, there are certain banks that really deserve, in particular, a lot of praise. Leader's one of them. In terms of taking care of their customers in a very prompt, organized way. And you can see the level of effort, as you described, put against it to make all that happen. Again, not easy, with a lot of energy and focus, connection with your customers, it gets done.
Thank you.
So, Bob, I received a question by email earlier from Ed Sevilla of the USS Constitution Museum. And he says that in the Boston Globe op-ed that you draft you wrote, you articulated, quote, a formula for finally delivering on foundational principles of fairness, equity, and inclusion. He'd like to ask your advice on how to put these principles into action. You mentioned cultural biases against minority-owned business enterprises. Could you unpack this idea a little bit in terms of the cultural biases for us?
Well, certainly. The African-American community has dealt with a long history history of abuse by our government and by banks in the past. So that there is a longstanding distrust and natural distrust of both institutions, if you will, by those communities. Many in our Latinx community, their families originate from countries where, again, the banks were not safe places to save. There were failures, there were corruption. There's not the natural security that many of us might have about banks that comes there as well. So again, there's a whole host of those slow the process down. Again, I think they can be overcome with positive experiences here, and I think in so many ways they have been for many. But if we're really going to help the minority business community and women-led businesses really thrive as they need to, I mean, one of the challenges here, I think for us, is that too many people leading the private sector look like me. And again, there's nothing wrong with us straight white males per se, but there aren't enough people of color, there aren't enough women, there aren't enough members of the LGBTQ plus community in these executive leadership roles, leading these boards. And that sends a signal. It sends a signal to those in those communities that you can't make it here. And unless we are very intentional at our larger companies in diversifying our executive leadership ranks and finding a way to develop that talent, and finding a way to diversify our boards, and at the same time, scaling those businesses in our own community and giving them a great opportunity to thrive. And we established the Foundation for Business Equity 3 years ago now with a three-pronged approach in partnership with the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce and the Boston Foundation to really address what we think are the pillars of the solution of this. The first is technical assistance. It's really a program dedicated for capacity building. And I'm glad to say that a number of business leaders in town over the last few weeks have been talking about how we take that approach and really expand it and scale it in a way that it hasn't been done before. So more to come on that, but it's very, very exciting and gives me a lot of hope that we can get some energy there. But again, if you don't, all the technical assistance in the world isn't going to help you unless you have access to financial resources and funding. So we set up the Business Equity Fund in conjunction with the Boston Foundation to drive more funding, creative patient capital to these businesses. But again, a technical assistance and financing still aren't enough. You need opportunities to grow, and that's contracts. And that's really where the chamber comes in through the Paysetter program. Mm-hmm. And that's what we can all collectively do, all businesses, whether it's through those on their own. But I think to the extent that we dedicated ourselves to outreach, building relationships, providing advice, helping with resources, and providing contracts and greater opportunities for contracts to our businesses of color, to our women-led businesses, and helping them scale. If we help them scale, we'll have a greater talent pool for these leadership positions. We have very talented people running small companies. They just don't have the time, like I would, with over 1,900 employees, to run around town and do things like this and come to the CEO club luncheons and serve it on boards. And that's a problem because, again, too many people like me are going to be in their own echo chamber, and we're not going to come up with the best solutions for a world that is now more challenging than ever, where we're faced with increasingly complex problems.
And I can't think of an organization that has come forward with a campaign that's titled Join Us for Good that doesn't really speak to the heart of what Eastern Bank is about. And it's not, in my mind, a marketing slogan, although it's catchy and well done. But when you see it around town, it means something to me, both about community and about what we're trying to do in this region to move things forward. And obviously, Eastern Bank, in you know, behind Rich and yourself and others who've been in that position, you know, take a look, for those of you who haven't, take a look at Eastern Bank's board, right? This is an organization that believes deeply in diversity and inclusion, not as a slogan, but as something that they live to help their business become better and our community become better. So kudos to you in Eastern. We've got a couple more questions. Thanks. I'm going to go to Tim first and then Mary Jo, but But Tim Wade, I think you're up next. See if we can get unmute you.
I agree with you entirely. East Bank, fantastic institution, and Bob does a great job of
Tim?
Diversifying. Yeah, that's what I was worried about. Am I in and out?
You're okay.
I'm catching you. All right. Keep going.
Okay, great. So anyway, really quickly, M&T did 33,000 applications, put $7 billion out on the street, actually approved 100% of those applications that were eligible, and only lost a couple thousand ineligibilities. But I think the most important thing, and I think things Bob was getting at, was 82% of our applications were below 250,000. 92% were for businesses less than 50 employees. So really oriented towards the small business. And Bob, I had a quick question for you. Any thoughts on this kind of it was said gently up front, but they're really making a much bigger deal about it now, this requirement that borrowers certify the necessity of the funds, and it's starting to get some people worried. And then there's the second half of that is the fact that the restaurateurs felt like they couldn't get the money back out the door fast enough in 8 weeks, and that was causing them problems. So people are giving the money back. Any thoughts to that or concerns about the certification?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question, Tim. And again, M&T is a fabulous company, and I'm not in that career at M&T. It is a true community bank, even though it's quite large. It's where Tim and I got to know each other initially, and it's such a pleasure to have him in town leading that org here. Tim, what you mentioned is the King Yoon saga of the Paycheck Protection Program. So here we are with the next chapter, right? Because of Shake Shack, Ruth, Chris, and others being called out justifiably for taking down these extraordinary amount of funds under corporate capture. Now it's set this ripple through in an audit stated by Mnuchin of all those who received more than any organization that received $2 million of audit, did they need it? Could they justify it? It's very scary. Now, I'm not sure to what degree, given the volume, that audit could truly be executed. But nonetheless, you wouldn't want to wait and find out. So certainly, we're seeing some of the companies that we do business with, some of the organizations that took down funds, even those that didn't take down $2 million. They just took down funds, and now they're questioning, am I going to get a hard time because I didn't really need it or need it as much as others? And should I give it back, even though they would have cut staff without it, which I think is really unfortunate. I think most unfortunate of all are those in our very small businesses, and as you mentioned, Tim, particularly our restaurants. The restaurants have done calculus here. And, they're looking at this and saying, boy, this is a very long road ahead for me. These monies aren't nearly going to help me get to the other side. I won't be able to ultimately maintain my payroll. And as a result, I won't get the loan forgiveness. This will just saddle me with more debt that I won't be able to pay. So they're also looking to give it back because it doesn't solve their problem. Add to it, there are a number of companies, restaurants and otherwise, are looking at this, and their employees don't want them to take advantage of the program because depending on the job, they're getting paid more on unemployment. And I've talked to some business owners that were very afraid of telling their employees that they got the loan, which meant they'd be kept on the payroll and not on unemployment, where they would earn, which is again, another unfortunate nuance in all of this that needs to be addressed.
Wonderful, thank you. We're going to turn next to Mary Jo, and after that, we have Barry Sloan up on deck. So, Mary Jo, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Bob, for everything that you've done. How are you? As usual, you're expressing so many of the values that so many of us in town believe in, and you're putting them into action, and I applaud you for that. What I'd love to hear you talk about is how do we, as we move forward, the governor has just put together his reopening advisory board. What do you think some of the core operating principles should be for them and for us as a community as we reopen with all the issues that you've just discussed in mind? I mean, how can we take advantage of this crisis, this transformative time that we're going through, and come out the other end in a different way?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mary Jo. And, you know, it's a tough one, right? We're in the middle of a crisis that has affected all of us in one way or another. And so when we look towards reentry and whatever form that takes, there are so many issues to be addressed. CERN is in the pursuit of those much larger issues that racial inequities and other social justice and sustainability issues will get pushed aside or not focused on to the degree necessary. Again, not because anyone is not well-meaning. I think people, it's just the task is so huge, and we've seen this before. We've seen it in good times, when in the pursuit of business, when things are strong, paying extra attention to some of these other issues gets hard because people are used to working a certain way, operating a certain way, and this requires change. This requires intentionality, to be mindful of it, and there's no question in my mind when it comes to communities of color, this is going to take additional resources. The natural process of reentry is not going to favor the people of color. Restaurants, when they reopen, will be restricted in the number of people they'll be allowed to serve because of social distancing. And that's justifiable, and that's true. And I think it's the right thing to do. Unfortunately, for those businesses, it's horrible. And for the workers in those businesses that lose hours and jobs, even worse. If you're in the hotel industry, the convention business, all these events that we go to, look at by women and people of color. Those are the that won't bounce recovery. And unless we are intentional about those businesses, about those communities, and providing resources and relief, not loans, but relief, they're going to be further left behind. They're going to be further injured, and the injury will be irreparable. So I feel good about the commission appointed, though. It certainly has some level of city from the business community perspective in the financial sector. I think as many of you know, Pam Everhart is on that commission. She's fabulous. She cares about these things. She's and having people like Pam on that commission gives me great faith that these issues will not be forgotten.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, good morning, everybody. Am I up? Yeah.
Hey, Barry.
Yes, I'm here. First, let me apologize for the hat. But if you saw me after 7 weeks without a haircut, as my wife says to me, I have wings now. So forgive me. Yeah, good morning. So we had, and Linda's here on the call.
Michelle, can
you... Sorry?
Not something a lot of...
A lot of people, it's the wings or the hat, Bob. Yours looks much more organized than mine. But let me say, so Linda's joining me on the call here this morning. And welcome to the CEO Zoom world, huh? This is fabulous. So I must say, we have a different view on the Triple P and our experience. You know, to me, it was a miracle. You know, we managed in the first round to get 1,000 loans done. By our estimate, saving something on the order of 15,000 jobs, you know, all in Massachusetts. So, you know, I give the SBA a straight A and a medal for standing this thing up in 9 days. And to most of the industry for doing an extraordinarily resourceful job. We had 11 people working 20 hours a day, 6 days a week. They need a break now, I'll tell you, it was fabulous. Now round two is altogether different. While the first was a mad sprint, round two is quite organized and has settled down. Virtually everybody knows the rules. The portal is still open. We have processed every client application that meets the criteria. So we've now moved on to non-clients, and we're getting a much reduced applicant flow. I think it's fair to say for those people that have interest in the program and for whom the criteria work, and they certainly don't work for everybody. Although I failed to understand these merchants or retailers or even the restaurants who are afraid that if they borrow the money, they won't spend it in the covered period appropriately, because your worst case is you have a 1% loan for 2 years. I mean, just repay it or keep it for capital. Or if you can't justify a 1% loan, in my view, you maybe ought to question the business. So we're in a very good place now, and people are beginning to think thoughtfully about what forgiveness means and what the rules will be. But I think importantly, to Bob, to your theme, we did over 350 not-for-profits in our loans done. In fact, the largest loan we made was to a not-for-profit that exclusively serves the communities of color. So we're very proud of that. Some very small not-for-profits really are staying in business throughout Eastern Massachusetts because of the Triple P program. And I think that was quite remarkable, because it's the first time, in to my knowledge, in SBA history that they allowed not-for-profits and faith organizations to participate. They were always prohibited. So I think the step now, you know, it's all about relationship. You know, people complain that, well, they didn't know anybody at their bank. Well, of course, I would make the case that they should have listened to us for a long time, right? That if you didn't have the name of your bank officer and his or her phone number or email, you're in the wrong bank. You know, I'm proud to say all of our customers had somebody to call. And if they didn't, they called me or they called Linda. And the two of us handled probably 50 of those over the last couple of weeks. And we got them all directed and in the right place. So now what we've asked our CRA officer to do is now go be proactive. There are certainly small merchants in all communities that don't have the experience or the expertise, and they need help. Well, then let's go give them some help. I mean, the portal is open. There's time remaining. And I think the frustration to me in the midst of this amazing achievement is, you know, while our congressional delegation criticizes the industry and our outreach and the demographics without even having any data yet, not one of them has done anything to help people apply. Not one of them has had that I'm aware of, and I participated in many local chambers of commerce calls, as Linda does, not one of them has, as we say, stood up a clinic to help people get their paperwork together and to see if they qualify. So there's always unintended consequences. There's always going to be fraud. There's always going to be inappropriate and embarrassing an embarrassing acts in a government program of this size. But to put $500 billion out on the street in 2 weeks is, to me, an amazing achievement. And I'll stop. Yeah.
And Barry, again, kudos to you and your team at Century. Clearly, you guys have done a fabulous job. I know that personally as well. As you know, I chair the Demick Center board in Roxbury, and your handling of their loan by your team was flawless.
Thank you, Bob.
Completed in the and really was a big thank you.
You're very kind. And to you for your leadership there. I am, of all of the many charitable organizations we're involved in, the remarkable success, growth, and mission of the Demick warms us all the time. Yeah. Well done.
Thank you. You guys have been pretty helpful. Thank you.
This has been terrific to see so many of our community city leaders, but banking leaders coming together on this call just to share and to applaud each other. It gives us a sense of hope and purpose that we are in this together, and there are some solutions. We have some great people in our town who are addressing this and are thinking about the bigger picture. Bob, as we discussed, I'm going to shift now and do what I call sort of a quick lightning round. It's a little bit more personal, but let's just start with some fun questions in terms of what's the last book that you've read?
Last book was The Water Dancer by Tanya Coates, who's a well-known African-American writer, formerly with the New York Times, a number of books. This is a particularly good one. It's a nonfiction, historical fiction about a slave who ended up running away through the Underground Railroad. It really gives you the experience in a different way of the horrors of slavery were like, without all the violence that you normally see, but the real, what life was like. And I highly recommend it.
That's a great recommendation. I have not read that, but certainly I'm familiar and aware of Ty Coates. And for those who aren't aware of him, you should certainly pick up some of his books. What's the last song or album that you've listened to, you've gone out of your way to play? What sort of music do you seek out?
So I'm a Kenny G fan, and my favorite album of his is Cosmic Hallelujah, which always gets me up. And while I was doing some chores before I left for the office this morning at home, had that playing. It's one I play often.
I'm sorry, I missed the, what was the name of the artist?
Kenny Chesney.
Oh, yes. All right. Yeah. And considering the time of day that you were sending me emails this morning, I suspect that Kenny Chesney was playing awfully early at your house.
It was. Yeah. But I kept it low. I didn't bother my neighbors. I don't think.
Excellent. What was your first paying job?
I was a paper boy for what was then called the Herald American, and did that for 6 years, elementary, junior high, and great experiences from that. Learned a lot from that one.
Yeah, I was a delivery person for the Boston Globe, and there are two things that you hated. You hated Sundays, and I hated rain. When you're out there delivering, the sunny day in the summer on a Thursday was fine. The rain day on a Sunday was not so much fun.
Yeah, that and collecting money, Warren. Thankfully they don't make people go door to door trying to get it.
Yeah,
another interesting experience.
It was. I was a 14, 15 year old kid on my bike knocking on people's doors asking them for cash. It's amazing that was sort of allowed back then. And it certainly gave me a sense of people and how they treated others. It really is a fascinating job.
No doubt.
If you could meet one living person today, who would that person be?
This made me sound like a fanboy, but it's not why I really want to meet him, and I never have. It's Tom Brady. Now, I'm a big Patriots fan and certainly admire what he's done on the field, but I really admire more what he's done with his life. I love how he handles himself, and I'd love to meet him and just get he is not only the greatest of all time in football, but one of the true neat and special people we've had in Boston.
Well, I know by watching the commercials that Eastern Bank runs every now and then that you seem to have access to David Ortiz. And so I would suspect that Big Poppy might be able to make an introduction at some point. So might want to put that on your list of things to do since, he's not allowed to go to the Tampa Bay parks anymore and work out. So he may have some free time to join you. I'm going to finish today with a last question that I stole from Linda Henry when she held a webinar on behalf of the Boston Globe recently, when she asked her guests to give us as your last item, share with us a message of hope, something that everybody on this call can take away with us today and moving forward that gives us hope and a smile moving forward.
You know, in these times, I've been reading a lot about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and believe truly that this is our FDR moment. This is our generation's FDR moment. And not because I think we're going to slip into depression, although I think we've got harder. Mass movement by the government is ensured that there's a floor that'll prevent depression as it was then. But I think it's laid bare again the inequities from a social safety net perspective that lacking, that need to be invested in. But really, you know, when I think about FDR, you know, the quote I'd want to share is this. And at the time, he said, "We have always held to the hope, the belief, the conviction that there's a better life, a better world beyond the horizon." And I believe that that's true in this case in so many ways too. But it really depends upon us to make it that way. And I think in so many ways, there's lots of dark clouds out there, but there are silver linings. And I know that we look back this time where so many of us will say that we met that moment. We made investments, we took those actions. And as a result, but all around us in our business community and our society became better as well. So that's the thing that really me going and thinking about. And again, together, once again, this community will rise above tragedy and become deeper going forward.
Well, that's fantastic. I know that my tradition has been to start the CEO Club events at the Boston Harbor Hotel with a quote. And I think it's fitting that you'll end today's virtual town hall with a fantastic quote from FDR and the sentiment, and a challenge to all of us who are on this call and in the city to rise up, to meet the challenges, to do what we need to do for the racial divide, for the socioeconomic divide, and for the good of both the businesses, the people, and certainly our region. I do want to thank everyone for joining us today. I know that you have other things that you could do, and you've joined us for this virtual town hall to continue to keep the Boston College Chief Executives Club as a community vibrant and engaged. So thank you to everybody and for dealing with whatever technology issues we've had. Thank you to Lauren and Gail for helping me once again. But most importantly, Bob, thank you for your time, for your leadership, for your message, and for sharing with us your vision for the city and the region. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Warren. Thanks, everybody. Be well.
Wonderful. Have a great day, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Bob Rivers, Chairman and CEO of Eastern Bank. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.